Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Sarah Kiley is a dance physiotherapist with a sports master's, and she's joining us today to talk about hamstrings and stretching and everything else in between. She has a new clinic on the Gold Coast called Inform Physio & Co. Welcome, Sarah. Sarah, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Welcome to the Prepoint Pod. Thank you very much for joining me today.
No, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, let's start with just, tell us about yourself and your dance background and the work that you do at the moment.
Yeah, so my name's Sarah, obviously. I'm a physio on the Gold Coast in Australia. I particularly work with dancers, but I also have finished my master's in sports. So I'm a titled sports physio, and I love to be able to bring the dance world and sport worlds together in how I do things. So I work in private practice. I've just actually opened my own performing arts physio clinic, which is super exciting as of about 8 weeks ago. So it's very busy at the moment. But really excited to see what we can do and what we can grow into to be able to support the community here and our dancers and our performing artists. But my dance background, I would say, is predominantly, commercial styles. I obviously did my ballet all the way through, as that was really reinforced as part of our training. But I was definitely, unfortunately, didn't have the right anatomy for anything full-time in the ballet side of things, but I did really love that side of my training and really valued what it provided for the rest of what I do. But I would say my favorite thing is obviously my tap, which all the ballet kids go, oh, that's a bit wild, but that's where I do my teacher certificates and things like that. And my physio background now is I'm about 8 years out of undergrad uni, but 3 degrees in, and worked with quite a bit of variety. So I work with mostly performing arts in my day-to-day life, but I've also worked for the Gold Coast Suns women's team for 2 seasons. I've worked a bit with the Australian Sprint Kayak Program with Paddle Australia, with the Surfing Australia, was actually the team physio for the Australian Bowls team. So I've definitely jumped in and around, and I love to bring all these amazing skills that we learn through performing arts and dance into the sport setting, but also bring what sport does well back to the dance setting. So it's been a bit of fun.
Yeah, that's a really nice broad spectrum of experiences there, and I think it is so important to have a bit of a dance background when you're treating dancers, but to also understand that I think sometimes where we're at with dance physio and healthcare for performing artists is a little bit behind sport. So it's nice to be able to bring, as you said, the things that sport does well back into dance. So we're going to cover that a little bit today in talking about hamstring injuries, because you have the background working with the women's Suns team. So Suns is the AFL or Australian football for people listening overseas. And they get a lot of hamstring injuries. But yeah, I guess my question is, when you're thinking about a hamstring injury a dancer would experience, how is that different to a hamstring injury that a football player would experience? And what are the similarities? So like what is there any crossover between the two?
Yeah, so interestingly, a lot of the literature, because obviously when we go into the physio world, we have to really keep checking where our evidence is at. And they do talk about or theorize those two separate mechanisms. So we have our stretch-based hamstring injuries and our speed-based hamstring injuries. And interestingly enough, I actually do see that crossover is relatively accurate, specifically working in those two very different populations. Dancers typically don't get those same mechanisms, especially in ballet, I would say, maybe a little bit more in commercial and some of the contemporary skills that people are pushing these days. But typically we see more of that slower stretch mechanism in dance. And from what we know about those, they actually happen quite high up at the tendon attachment. They're not true muscle strains in the same way we see them in other sports. Whereas in obviously the football, a lot of that is our speed-based hamstrings. So we see them really high-speed sprinting is when they occur, and at that last little bit of that leg swing right before it's about to hit the ground. So it's still in a stretch mechanism but under a high load of contraction, whereas in our dance population we typically see it more as a slower overstretching type principle. So yeah, two very different mechanisms, and I'd say the reality matches up with the literature on that one, where you're not having the same mechanism at all of injury. Yeah.
And so when we're talking about like the slow stretch and the area of pain that someone might feel, so like we're talking right up high on the sit bone area where the tendon of the hamstring touches to the issue of tuberosity, so that sort of really high up, almost like buttock pain. And then like the sprinting or the speed-based hamstring injuries, you're talking about being in the muscle belly of the hamstring, so in that meaty part of the back of the thigh, a little bit closer to the knee.
Yeah, and they typically talk about it also being two different parts of the hamstring. I love asking dancers how many hamstrings they have.
Yeah.
I like to throw all my anatomy stuff into our sessions. And I think a lot of them do actually get a little bit shocked that there's three the muscle belly's there. And so we see in dancers, it's actually the semimembranosus, which is a different muscle to the ones we see in sport, which is more your long head biceps. So, and they actually both have different roles, because the semimembranosus actually drives the knee bending motion a little bit more, whereas the biceps long head is actually more the hip driven hamstring. So it's interesting that we actually see them happen in two different parts of the hamstring in two different locations. And I think that's where probably we do have to treat them differently. And that's sometimes where it gets a little bit gray. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when it comes to rehabbing these different injuries, like there are different considerations as well. So I guess with the slow stretch type injury versus the speed type injury, there are different sort of things that you might need to rest from or modify in your training, right, as you are coming back in to dance or to sport.
And I think it's criticized across both of them that a lot of the recurrence rates, we see them happen and repeatedly happen quite a lot in both situations. I would say that, I'm not sure if your experience is the same, but one of the biggest criticisms specifically in the footy is that we see you'll see it in the news all the time, you know, so-and-so player has done it again, you know, their hamstring again. And we see a really high recurrence rate, but interestingly, in both cases, the return to sport timeline is quite different, and it's actually the dance-based mechanism up at the tendon. It's meant to be quite significantly longer. I was reading a study where they were saying it can take up to 50 weeks to return it back to complete previous level of function, whereas we're talking more, not obviously they return to sport a lot quicker, but some studies are reporting, you know, a half that time. So with the muscle-based ones. So it's very different presentations, and because it's in a different area, we know tendons heal slower, they don't have that same healing capacity that a muscle does, so yeah, we get very different return to sport timelines. So that's why the management's quite different too, because the other thing that's really interesting with the dance ones is they often are less symptomatic, so they'll report less symptoms and they'll go back, but it's not actually back at its full level of function. Whereas the muscle-based ones, you'll see the symptoms are more predominant, but once they settle, it reflects a little bit more the healing component. So yeah, they're very different and very contrasting in how they present.
Yeah, I think too, sometimes in my clinical experience, there's quite a lot you can actually go back and do as a dancer without aggravating or irritating it. And it's usually like that right end of range, like really end of maximal hamstring stretch, like, or right at the very bottom of a split where someone will feel it, or they have to repeat something over and over again for it to get sort of sore again after a period of time of healing. If people go back, say maybe after a term of rehab or something, and they'll be able to do quite a lot, but it's just those very specific end of range stretch, really extreme stretching things that aggravate it. And I think so it's easy to be, I guess, fooled in a sense to in thinking that it's like fully ready to go back. And then you try that thing that hurt it the first time and it's still sore,
and
then
it goes
backwards. Whereas you're right, you're probably gonna have that sort of protective pain, I guess, in a hamstring belly kick in a little bit sooner because it's
you can ask a dancer to still do quite a lot with their legs, say below 90, but you can't really ask a football player to not sprint on a football field in the middle of a game. Like there's you know, not ways, there's a ways around it. And so I think we're quite similar in that, in the way that we do probably take dancers back into the setting a lot sooner, because if we can be really smart with how we modify things, we can keep some load there. And I think that's why being a physio with a background in dance, we can talk that language and actually help a dancer to find a middle ground and find a way to still participate but rehab at the same time. Because I think where they get really frustrated is when they're told to just do nothing. And we know that's actually not good for recovery either. So it's finding a happy medium. But whereas in the AFL, it's really interesting because obviously with a lot of them occurring in a high speed sprint, they've done quite a few studies to try and find what exercises we can do to strengthen a hamstring to that level of load that we experience in a high speed sprint. And a Nordic gets the closest. So anyone listening that doesn't know what we're talking about, it's that one where you see people hold their ankles down and they look like they're doing the free fall while sitting on their knees. That gives the highest load in that muscle that we can get eccentrically to match a high speed sprint. And it's still only, I think, 70% of what a high speed sprint is. So we actually can't induce that high enough and have to really slowly expose them to it over a couple of weeks. And what we're really fortunate, and we had a chat about this a couple of weeks ago, actually, in the footy setting and in professional sport, we have a sports scientist sitting on the side of the field, and every player has a GPS tracker in, and we are watching how fast they are sprinting, how much volume they're running, how much they're doing over a session. And we're able to pull them and put them out based on, you know, what we need them to be doing. And that's really hard to do in the dance setting. So there's, you know, obviously with dancers, we can take them back and try and create modifications, but we have less maybe control over that. And that's why you said there's that slippery slope to accidentally going too far again. Such different settings to be experiencing injuries in and return to sport.
Yeah, exactly. So no one in the ballet world has a GPS tracker on that's counting, or a movement tracker on that's counting how many high kicks you're doing or how many split leaps you're doing or how many leg mounts you're doing. It would be so cool.
I would love to know. There are ways to do it.
It's just it's not at a point where it's rolled out to the community. I think that's the issue. But if we could count, then we'd be able to say, right, well, you can do X number of these particular movements in a session, and then we'll have a rest and then slowly increase it, just like an AFL player would do with sprinting coming back.
It just requires such a good relationship with the whole team, like the teachers and the students and the parents, to really make that happen. It's like really relies on everyone being invested in it, because that is so much harder to control. But if one day someone can tell me how many in each session we're doing, I'd love to know more. So we need like an AI that watches a class and then counts the movement types or something.
We're probably not far off it, probably not far off it. It's interesting having the whole team invested. I think something like that can seem a little bit unfamiliar in a dance setting, just because we're not used to that sort of level of monitoring. But if at the end of the day, it means that a dancer doesn't need to stop dancing all the time, like for 2 weeks, say, to settle this thing down that they've aggravated because they've made a really slow return, it could be really advantageous to have that information. So you keep on that positive trajectory rather than up and down and up and down and up and down.
Yeah. And I always really work hard with my dancers to encourage that open discussion with their teachers. Cause I think, you know, as dancers, we are told to be really respectful of our teachers and to not, you know, we don't like, they can get very stressed when there's a lot of people in the room and there's a lot happening. And so we can get, the younger ones can get quite scared to approach them. But I always talk to them about, you know, even my experience as a dance teacher, you know, teachers can get frustrated when they're given problems all the time. And a kid comes up and goes, I'm sore, I have to sit down, and it's just a problem. And you can see that frustration. And I know I felt it myself. I actually had to pull myself up on it once and go, oh, actually, you know, hold on a second. That's not a them problem. Like, I have to watch that. But I always talk to my dancers about, you know, and this is why I think the dance specific physio and us knowing what they're doing is really important, because I talk to them about going to their teacher with the solution and the problem to try and make this a better situation. So, you know, I've hurt my hamstring. I've actually already seen a physio about it. This is what I can and can't do. And when I can't do that, I've got this to do on the side. Is that okay with you? And as soon as they're, you know, being given the solution, the teacher can take a sigh of relief because they don't have to think about it. We can help manage it with the teacher and with the student, and we've got a really fantastic relationship. So I think it's just really trying to open those communication channels as much as possible.
Yeah, that is it, isn't it? It's having a solution, and it's also quite empowering for the dancer too, because rather than walking into a class and not knowing whether what they're going to do is going to aggravate an injury, no, instead they have something there that they know is going to be safe, and it's there's a sense of empowerment that a dancer can have too when they, you know, when they have everybody on board.
Whereas in the sport world too, sorry, I was just gonna say, it might be from your experience at Queensland Ballet and in more elite settings, but you know, in elite sport, the player doesn't probably have as much need or doesn't experience that same situation, because we will have meetings on a regular basis, like 2 to 3 times a week, with coaching, admin, nutrition, psychology, doctor, physio, everyone is in there, and we are going through every player on the list and where they're at in every department. So everyone is always on board, and that communication, I think that's what I try to bring back into practice, because that's where we get the best results, is when everyone's on board. And maybe it does happen a little bit better in that next level up, in that professional and professional setting, but at a studio level, which is where we, and I don't know about you, but that's where we see a lot of this kind of injury, it's really trying to find and take that, you know, experience and bring that communication back into the setting of the studio.
Absolutely. Yes. And it does happen at a professional and a pre-professional level. And I think it's definitely for the benefit of the dancer. And, you know, quite often you'll get teachers or coaches coming forward with the solution, you know, and they are the ones suggesting modifications or change of casting, or, you know, they want to make it work for the dancer. So yeah, I guess it's contrary to perhaps what a lot of dancers at a community level think about the professional setting, in that you just work hard and there's no end to it, but there is actually a lot of compromise and conversation and you know, a team behind a dancer.
For sure.
Going back to hamstrings.
Yes,
it's all totally relevant, but I am interested in crossovers between dance and AFL hamstring rehab. You talked about Nordics, but for hip mobility, so I don't know if you've ever watched or had a look at a photo of an AFL player taking a kick. They do some pretty high kicks. And they're also required to run very fast. Like, often they'll be down on the field grabbing the ball and then immediately sprinting and then immediately taking a kick, which is such a big range of motion for a hamstring to go through. Are there any sort of exercises or rehab approaches that you sort of use in both settings, for dancers and for football players?
What's really interesting is I think both could learn more from each other. I think that the AFL world, the approach is very much in the gym. So a lot of it is, you know, deadlifts and Nordics and raises and eccentric loading, which we know and we'll probably get to this because this is where we kind of come back and this is where we question a lot of our dance ways of managing this, but we know that stretching doesn't actually change fascicle length of the muscle. So we know that there's other mechanisms involved in how stretching works, but I did another quick check over any out like new literature, and it's really, there is nothing to prove yet that we actually can change the length of the muscle via stretching. So this is where the AFL, I think it's really fantastic to see it applied, where you see those crazy kicks and things that they're doing, but they're not sitting in the splits. I tell you, they're not doing the splits against the wall or pulling their knee to their head. They are doing strength through range, and they have incredible dynamic range of motion and power that they use to get there. But I honestly wouldn't say I see many of them just stretch a hamstring. I don't think I ever, they have the most beautiful warm up and they really have all this like pre-training prep, post-training prep, gym training programs, and you won't ever see them sitting there in a stretch. You'll often see them doing walking hamstring, like lean forwards. You'll see leg swings, lots of dynamic stuff, and then they're getting that long-term length and resilience from their strength work in the gym. So I think that's where dance could take from them. However, I also had to really adjust to very less flexible bodies when working in the AFL, where they don't actually sometimes have that resting range of motion that the dancer has. So maybe we could take a little bit from that book and go, well, I think I even had a few of these arguments in my master's around don't stretching's useless, train in the gym. And I'm like, actually, I don't think stretching is useless. I think it has its place. And I think we could all learn from having better range of motion and establishing a better baseline in order to not expose our muscles to that much load. However, where the dance, so dance, I think, is a little bit better in that aspect, where we actually want to stretch into ranges of motion that we therefore want to work in. Like, I think that's the matchup I see better. I don't think I would ever see a hamstring in a footy player that matches those photos that you see. Like, I wouldn't take them in a straight leg raise and see the same range of motion that you're seeing in that photo. Whereas a dancer, I can take their leg as high as they want their leg to go. So I think that's where the matchup is, whereas the dance could obviously work a little bit more on that strength training side of it. So I would say the crossover isn't there in how we're addressing it, but both of them could take from each other a little bit more, I think, and it would potentially bring us to a better place.
That's a, yeah, I really like that, that we've reached that conclusion. I think that's so interesting. So I wonder too, like with hypermobility and sort of self-selection into sport, do you think some of that range in the dancers comes from the fact that they're a bit hypermobile and, or they are hypermobile, and that's sort of why they're dancing and why their sort of chosen sport is dance, and maybe AFL players are not as hypermobile, but, you know, they're strong, they're powerful. You know, what do you think that there's a difference in maybe body type or anatomy, like with those populations? Or would you say that you've seen some AFL players who potentially are a bit hypermobile as well, and they just need to do more range of motion? And then there's some dancers who aren't hypermobile who still have that range of motion?
I think I used to be very much in the ballpark of it's the hypermobility and it's the body type. But after working in so many now different sports and very different sports and seeing so many different crossovers in body type, I genuinely think that it's not necessarily the case, because how many times would you see a hypermobile dancer and what is their number one complaint is tight hamstrings? Yeah. Like, it's almost every single time, because that muscle is gripping on for dear life to give them some stability. And then you've also got some of your, like, I did definitely have a few more hypermobile players, and even working in the paddle, you would be incredibly amazed. These are strong, powerful kayaking athletes, and all of them were really quite hypermobile. So there's more crossover, I think, than we give respect for. And, you know, my horrible analogy, but the one I always run with my dancers is I always go, you know, you've got your spaghetti straight out of the packet that hasn't been cooked yet, and you've got your spaghetti that's been cooked really well, and then, you know, that spaghetti that mum didn't quite cook for long enough and it's a bit chewy. We all want to land in the middle. And I think, I don't necessarily think we can just say that's sport specific anymore. I think the way that we've moved into high performance sport, and the way we, the more we know about training and physical development, I think different body types can land in different sports necessarily and can train to achieve what they want now. I think it's a little bit less about, oh, you're made for that and that's what your body will do. It's actually, well, that's what your body is like, but this is what we can do to make you, you know, at your best in this sport. And I think that's where I've actually moved away from that thinking a little bit of that self-selecting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's really interesting. And I think that's important, I think, for people to hear too. Yeah, you can't just blame it on your genetics.
Yeah, I think there's like, and yeah, like I said, the number of times that we'll see the hypermobile dancer, and they'll be shocked when you call them hypermobile because they'll say that I've got really tight hamstrings and I can't do the splits. So I think like that's where I had to keep questioning myself a little bit. And that's why I say that we could take more from the sports settings in terms of the strength side of things, because that's when you're hypermobile people, we know they're tight because they're trying to be stable. And when they are strong, they're actually more flexible. So it's a lot of reverse engineering the traditional dance ways of thinking. And I think that really applies when we come back to the hammy stuff. And I guess what we'll get into when we're talking about addressing it is I genuinely find the hamstrings aren't the problem half the time in dancers. And so it's not usually what I'm trying to fix, but yeah, I think that's why both could take from each other. There's not as much crossover as I wish there was, probably the best way to put it.
That's great. That's so good. Excellent food for thought. My next question is, dancers often go through a phase of reduced hamstring flexibility, and I'm doing the little inverted commas on the camera, but you can't see that in the podcast. And that usually happens during adolescence. And it can be really frustrating. So a dancer who maybe at primary school age used to be quite flexible, used to be able to get into the splits, et cetera, then they sort of hit puberty and they lose some of their flexibility, again, in inverted commas. What can dancers and teachers do as part of training to get through that kind of rough patch of reduced mobility?
My number one thing is education. I think when you understand it, it's a whole different situation. And I think this is where we've got to bridge the gap with dance and healthcare and things like that, is it's actually just understanding. I think dancers, we know our show must go on mentality. We know that we just push harder when we can't do something. Oh, I can't do the splits. I'll sit there for an extra 30 minutes and that will help me get the splits. You know, like we push harder at things when they're resisting rather than wondering why they're resisting and trying to understand it a little bit better. And so my biggest thing to get through that patch is just talking about it and knowing what's normal, what's not. And I love it actually ties in with the pre-point podcast, in that one of the best times to have some of those discussions about growth spurt changes is in that pre-point assessment, honestly, because I find that's where we're actually having that chat about what changes during growth spurts and what we will experience in our body. And yes, we will tighten up for a period of time. That's really normal, especially when you see some of those kids go from tiny to tall really quick.
Yeah.
And it's just saying, you know, there's parts of this that are normal. So rather than getting angry at yourself and being hard on yourself and forcing yourself, just know that if you're consistent and if you're understanding what you're doing and you're doing the right things, it will come back. It's just a case of, and not everyone's going to go through it at the same time. So, you know, you're going to lose. I think that's the hardest part, because in dance, we're very comparing to each other in a room. And so there's one kid that's lost it and gone through the inverted commas, you know, issue with their flexibility. And it's horrible to them when the rest of the room isn't going through it. But then when they come out the other side, half the other kids are going through it. So I think it's just, that's why I say education, because at the end of the day, we all do it, you know. And once they understand what's normal and that they don't, it's not them being, you know, even for the parents and the teachers to understand, the kid isn't being lazy. They're not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
You know, there's elements to it that we have to understand is normal human physiology, and it will continue to improve, and we encourage consistency and, you know, safe practices and good understanding of flexibility training. So I think that's my biggest approach, is funny enough, not forcing it.
Yeah. That's, yeah. I mean, that's extremely good advice. I think the other thing that, I mean, when you were talking about pre-point assessments beforehand, and it is a good time to discuss growth and development, because usually dancers start point right at the beginning of puberty or right in the thick of puberty, when you are going through such a big growth spurt. But it's so common that I will do a hamstring or like a straight leg raise test in a pre-point assessment, and the dancer won't achieve 90 degrees. And I would say that more often than not, when I'm doing a pre-point assessment, the dancer is in that stage of sort of reduced mobility. And I would say that talking about hamstring mobility is one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing in that assessment.
Yeah, and I also find it comes up a lot because we also talk about, you know, stage of puberty and the periods and things like that, which helps us to understand timing of peak height velocity. And so when we know where they are in their puberty, it also helps us to know or anticipate where we are in that peak height velocity trajectory. And that's just a really nice period of time that, you know, in front of the parent and the kid, I usually say like a typical female will have 6 months of growth. And then they'll typically then at that point get their period. And obviously we know in some dance populations where they're leaner, this can be delayed or different. And then in the following 12-month period, they're going to be due to hit their peak height velocity. So they're going to be growing at their most rapid. So when you've got them at that time and maybe they haven't got their period yet, or they're on that first 6-month phase, it's just saying to them, hey, it's coming. So let's get started now and let's be consistent, because it's going to come. And the more consistent we are, the less chance we have of going backwards. And I think when the parent also hears that and the kid hears it, and we're all talking about how it's coming and this is a nice way to anticipate that feeling and know what you're feeling in your body, I think that really helps them to understand as well.
Yes, the peak height velocity assessment is good. Do you use like an online calculator to work that out? There's one from
sometimes
a Canadian university that I will use.
The University of Saskatchewan. Oh, I get pulled up on this every time.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to try and say it.
I'm going to link the calculator in the show notes just in case there are any clinicians who are listening who haven't used it before. Because it's a Canadian website, you have to be putting your dates in back to front.
Yes.
And it's actually yesterday in Canada. So because it's a real time calculator. So there is a couple there are a couple of catches, but it is a really good one.
And I found quite accurate, funny enough. I thought in the population with delayed growth, I thought it might be a bit inaccurate, but I've done it for the last 5 or 6 years now and just watched a few of those kids. And actually most of them have been pretty much on the ball with that. And I like that it's not going off percentage of, percentiles at 2 years old. Like it's a little bit more time appropriate. So yeah, I think stuff like that, like I said, education and getting through that phase. I think there's also, you know, like we said, there's tons of actual things we can do with hamstring mobility. We can work on neural mobility and the surrounding muscle groups, and we can work on, different types of stretches. And there's so much at our feet in terms of what we can do that isn't just sitting in the splits, which is my biggest no-no for hamstring stretching. But I think just being able to talk about it, I think, is my first step. And, you know, I think opening that discussion rather than it being something that's talked about so negatively.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, at the end of the day, everybody is going to experience it. So, you know, it's not just the fault of one person or one dancer or we started mentioning actually some of the things that you like to do to improve the splits. So things like neural mobility, which I agree is a great start. Is there anything else that you would recommend for a dancer who's wanting to improve extensions and splits? Without giving away all of your secrets.
No, that's okay. I love to give them away because I wish we knew more about this stuff as a dancer. Like I get frustrated that I know now. My splits are flat and square now and they weren't as a kid. So, you know, I wish I knew some of this when I was younger, and the more I can share, the better. But funny enough, you can ask any of my patients that I've worked with for a long time, and it's rarely stretching the hamstrings. My go-tos are everything around it. So I do a lot of work with quad length, because obviously we get a lot of those kids with really tight quads and hip flexors controversially, but I tend to find it's more the quads, not the hip flexors in these kids. And then we know the anterior tilt of the pelvis. So when they're going for the non-physios, when they're sticking their bottom out, so when they're tipping forward in their pelvis, we know that actually puts more stress and strain on the hamstring. So they go into a split or a hamstring stretch, but they're already, you know, 10 meters behind the start line of the race.
Yeah.
because of the tilt.
So that sit bone is already up in the air rather than underneath. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So now the hamstring has a lot further to go in order. And I make them stand there. It's a really nice task for anyone listening who's not understanding, is if you stand up and I say, put your hands on your hips and stick your bottom out, and now kick your leg, but keep your bottom stuck out. And then I say, and can you feel your hamstring? And then I say, now tuck your bottom under and do the same thing again. And you can feel that it goes further and it doesn't pull a stretch as much. And so it's just showing them that the hamstring is in the middle of your body, but there's all these things on either side that are connected. And so we can actually be a bit nicer to our hamstrings, I think. And most of my dancers know it's often the last thing I go for. I do a lot of quad lengthening. I do a lot of calf lengthening, obviously, because we know they cross over at the back of the knee. And we have with our fascial paths and things like that, we know that there's that connection through there. And I find that makes a big difference for a lot of them. I do a lot of lower back mobility and spinal mobility. I do a lot of piriformis glute stretches, because obviously we know with the sciatic nerve passing through the back of the glutes there. And in these ballet dancers who are so high tone through their turnout muscles because they've got them on all day, we've got a lot more, tightening and pressure around the sciatic nerve. So funny enough, my go-to for these people is actually I take a break off their hamstrings and I look at all the other areas that we could put some more attention into. And I find that you can get pretty fantastic changes and light bulb moments, funny enough, by addressing the other areas. I think the hamstrings get a lot more blame than they deserve sometimes.
Yeah. It's funny, yeah. Like this, maybe we should make the title of this episode Hamstrings But Not Hamstrings.
So funny. Yeah, it actually is a bit of that though. It's like, I don't know. I think it's really funny. Over time, I've really transformed, taken my clinical experience with the dance experience and put them together and gone, hold on a sec. It's just taking, we've got all these preconceived ideas as dancers growing up about what it is. Don't even get me started on back stretches. But, you know, we've got these preconceived ideas of what that feeling means, and we actually have to sometimes look out of the box a little bit. And I, you know, even with just challenging what we believe stretching is, you know, actually having the discussion of what is a stretch and what actually is changing when we stretch. Because even when you tell them that you don't actually change the length of the muscle. I think there was one animal study that got a muscle length change of the fascicles in the muscle, but they held the animal in a stretch position for 24 hours. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Don't try that at home.
So it's not realistic, right? It's not realistic. No. So all we're doing is we're changing.
Was the animal alive?
I think it was immobilizing the limb in a stretch position.
Right.
I went through a few because they can't obviously replicate these in humans. So I think it's actually challenging.
For a good reason.
So we're challenging what are we perceiving is changing when we hold a stretch. And we know there's a big component of what we called that theory around tolerance, stretch tolerance. And so we're actually trying to change our tolerance to the length of the muscle and the stretch sensation. We're not trying to change the length of the muscle. And I think it's having a lot of discussions around that and changing our approach to flexibility that really gets the biggest benefits.
Nice. I've got one final question.
Okay.
What are your go-to pair of point shoes? This is the pre-point pod. So I usually ask my guests what they're, or if you're not a point shoe wearer currently, what did you used to wear?
It's been too long for me, but if I put my physio hat on to answer the question, I'm going to say any pair that isn't a dead pair of point shoes.
That's a great answer.
All my patients can vouch for that answer. But I guess as a physio, I really love being able to work alongside the point shoe fitters whenever I get a kid come in a pair of energetics, because I love that we can work on different shank stiffnesses to help support them as they increase their training loads. I like an energetics because I like that I have more options to help a student who either needs a softer or a harder shank. But like I said, the physio hat in me, because it's been too long since I got to wear a pair myself, because questionable if I'd pass my own pre-point assessment these days. But I can say that all my full-time girls will laugh when I say any pair that is not a dead pair.
I think that's totally fair. Yeah. Yep. No, that's a great answer. And so energetics I would think probably a lot of dancers choose them because they are a little bit harder, and a lot of full-time dancers choose them because they don't die as quickly.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I mean, and obviously the shape of them is sometimes attractive. Sometimes I find that maybe they can be a little bit too hard for a dancer who isn't maybe as experienced, but I think you mentioned also working alongside fitters. So
I have the most incredible ladies here at Dance Desire who I literally send them messages from treatment rooms with photos of kids and videos of them going on rise. I'm like, this point she's breaking in funny, what's happening here? And they are incredible. I leave it all to them. Whenever they ask me questions in here about point shoes, I take the videos, I look at the foot in the shoe, and then I send it all to the store and I go, all right, girls, tell me what's going on. It's in your hands, because I think there's such an incredible world of knowledge that goes alongside point shoes. It's super physiological, like superhuman stuff to be dancing on your toes. That's not normal. So I do leave it to the point shoe fitters, and I'm so lucky to have such amazing ones here.
Yeah. And it definitely, you know, you definitely need that sort of special knowledge of the shoes that you have in stock and the shoes that are available. As physios, we can't keep up with that. But yes, no. I have been known to also video a foot and maybe not send it straight to the fitter. I mean, that's a great idea.
I love that one. We have instant messaging back and forth, and we just like sending bulk messages and we change shoes. I had one girl walking the other day with four different pairs and I had a look at them, and then I sent her back to the point shoe fitter and said, these are my opinions. What's your opinions? Mm. You know, it's an incredible relationship, and I think it's made a big difference to a lot of kids, both on the high, you know, the elite end in their full time that, you know, are having issues with them breaking too fast, all the way down to the pre-point end where they can't quite get the right fit or they're having pain or coming back from injury, now needing a different shoe. It has made so many lives so much better having that relationship with the point shoe fitters.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, sometimes I'll send a video on a patient's phone in with my voice saying, so when they're rising up, this is happening and this is what we're trying to avoid and blah, blah, blah. And that's amazing. Yeah, that's great. I remember when I was training, so because I lived on the Northern Rivers of New South Wales, so Dance Desire was actually the closest big shop where to go and have, you know, a fitting and try on multiple brands. And I think that's where I had my first point shoe fitting actually, or maybe my second point shoe fitting.
And Lauren is so dedicated to getting so many different brands, and she keeps expanding their range more and more, I feel like, by the week. And it's been so amazing to be able to find, you know, shoes for kids with different feet types and make it more enjoyable for them, you know, rather than squish them into something that's not comfortable. So yeah, it's been a huge benefit from a point perspective to help these kids work their way through that area. When, like I said, back to the team situation, when we're all on the same page.
Totally. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time today. I know
thank you for having me.
I actually have to go and see a patient now.
I do. I have to go keep put my physio hat on.
So yeah, I mean, it's been great to chat. I love the way that you approach these situations, and it's been wonderful for you to share some of your knowledge with our listeners.
Thank you. And thank you for providing a platform to do it. That's the biggest thing, is being able to talk about this stuff and make it more well known. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Have a lovely day.
You too. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.